Welcome to Executives After Hours, real conversations with real leaders. This is your host, Dr. James Kelly. I want to make you a promise that over the next 60 minutes, you will learn at a minimum two things. One, every leader and executive makes mistakes on the way to the top. And two, and more importantly, everyone has a unique story to tell. And that's what we do here on Executive After Hours. We sit down with leaders across a variety of industries, and we talk to them about their unique story. So welcome to the community, and stay tuned for today's episode on your Executives After Hours. Hello, everybody. Welcome to Executive After Hours. This is your host, Dr. James Kelly. To those of you checking this out for the very first time, I say a thank you for your time, energy, and willingness to sit down and listen to these podcasts. Today's episode, I had the pleasure to interview Jake Nicole. He is the founder of 180drums.com. It's basically your online resource for drum instructions. It's really well done, super professional, and he's had some amazing drummers on his show, on his website, giving instructions to people. So I'll let him tell you who they are. They're come from quite a few famous bands. So well done him. He's a very mature man and really awesome to talk to. He's in his 20s, but you can tell he has wisdom beyond his years already. Also, his name is just rad. Like, what a great name. It sounds like he belongs in the rock industry. So anyhow, enjoy the episode. Just want to say thank you to my content partner, C-Suite Radio, as well as Transformation Radio. Finally, as always, please do a review on iTunes. And if you want to be part of the book, editing, giving feedback, please go to drjameskelly.com, K-E-L-E-Y. Click on the book tab and sign on up, and I'll send you some information. All right. Everyone, have an awesome week. Enjoy the episode. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. And all right. See you. So, Jake, where are you actually at? So just to kind of, you know, as I've rambled here for the first few minutes, can you just quickly give my audience the 10,000-foot level of who you are, where you're at, and what you do?
Yeah. So my name's Jake Nicole. I live near Toronto. That's the easiest way I like to describe it. I live in a city called Hamilton. And my background is, you know, growing up as a musician, I traveled and toured and did that immediately out of high school. Had this real ground level experience with sales and with going straight from, instead of, you know, denying all my university potential applications, going straight to traveling on the road. And it taught me the most about what it really means to survive. You know, traveling in a band is just super raw and brutal. And yet it taught me so much. And then kind of getting to a space where I started to really realize that the best value I had to offer wasn't going to be traveling in the road. It was going to be getting into the online space and just seeing everything moving there. And then beginning to build all these great relationships with drummers like Stevie Wonder's drummer and Drake's drummer and Paramore's drummer, all these big acts, and realizing that there was a real opportunity to create education that would be online. And that kind of began the early stages of 180 Drums. And then since then, I began to venture off into kind of different areas of business with starting a podcast myself as well, and really using that as a tool to connect and network with different people. And that's about where I'm at today. I'm 25 years old, and it's been an awesome ride, man.
So what made you decide to get off or out of the daily grind of the band stuff?
Yeah, you know what? It was just seeing so many other people who were doing it, and without naming any specific names, it was seeing even some guys that were playing with really big artists and were just incredibly undervalued and underappreciated. And I think it's not to blame artists. It's that supply and demand is so, there's so many great musicians out there that musicians don't really have to respect their drummers or guitar players quite at the same level. So I just realized, man, this isn't something that can scale much past $1,000 a gig. And while that sounds like a lot, that gig can disappear real quick. And you're kind of a slave to the machine, you know? So I just really started to realize, man, I want to create value for people who are interested in education. And I think that's a better avenue for me to use my talent.
So I think for me, there's this allure, and you're still really young. So there's this allure to being on the road, kind of being the road guy. So was there a circumstance or time where you were like, in this moment, you decided I'm out, I can't do this?
Yeah. Yeah. And for me, it was at the height of what I had started to experience as a musician. It was, you know, going out and traveling with bands, getting to be on the bus and then getting flown out for a couple fly dates and just realizing like, man, this is more of a grind than anything else. And you're like scrapping to try and find meals on the road. And it's a hard life, you know, and I have a ton of respect for those who do it. And I have even more respect for those who love it because it enables them to play music. But for me, it was really realizing that it was not the lifestyle I had set out to build, and it wasn't going to be the one I wanted to expose my family to later on in life.
So then, speaking of your family then, you know, and I always have to throw this out whenever I talk to Canadian, I'm half Canadian. So my mom is from Etobicoke, and I'm fairly sure I have family in Hamilton somewhere. I know I do in London and Mississauga.
Yeah, you got it.
And my other cousin lives in Toronto. So I'm half Canadian. I take that claim when I talk to Canadians because then I feel like it brings down the border wall. Whatever.
Yeah.
So talk to me about your family then, because was music a huge part of your upbringing?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it's a great question because music really wasn't in a lot of ways for me. It was actually growing up, I think more than anything, being exposed to music at church where there was a community of musicians. And it's really funny because as I've started to encounter some of the most talented drummers in the world, you know, sitting down with, like I mentioned earlier, Stevie Wonder's drummer or Drake's drummer or, you know, Bieber's drummer, all these different artists, realizing like all these guys got their chops because they were 5, 6 years old, growing up in church, sitting on some dude's lap playing the kit. And that's just an exposure that a lot of musicians, like you'll find a lot of really talented over-the-top musicians have this background of growing up at a super young age with either a musical family or growing up in a community like a church where they get to play every weekend.
So it kind of goes back to my point then. If your family wasn't that musically inclined and there was something in there that spoke to you, right, that whole wonder of it. So what was it that spoke to you?
Man, it's so simple. It's when I would watch drummers play early on when I was growing up in church, watching that guy up on stage play drums, there was like this maniacal behavior to the drum set that's just so beautiful. It's like chaos and structure and power and finesse. It's all of these really beautiful components of what make up just the drums in general that are so appealing. They're so beautiful. So that was what drew me. It was just the allure of the drums. And I remember just, yeah, being absolutely mesmerized watching the drummer play.
So, you know, as a parent whose kid plays drums and he's 9.
I'm so sorry.
No. Like, so I'll come back in a second to that. You know, how did your parents take to you picking that instrument?
Oh man, my mom was really supportive and that's about all there is to say about that. And I honestly had to time it around my dad's schedule and knowing when he'd be home from work. And I had a window of time. And you know what though? I get it because now with age, you know, while I was getting older, my dad was getting better at it. And a lot of that was just because, you know, I was also getting better.
Yeah, exactly.
That's it. I was getting better too. It was a little easier to listen to. But early on, it was definitely my mom was never bothered by it. But I could imagine it being even myself if some kid's in a music shop and he's like, you know, tearing apart a drum set, I'm way less inclined to want to hang out in that same space and feel comfortable. You know? So.
So, I mean, I will say, and I'm pretty critical of my kids and their talents. I'm not one of these parents who are like, oh, my kid's amazing at X. Like it's not, and they suck, right? Like it's not, I'm not like that. I'm a realist. My son has an incredible ear for music and he's only been taking drum lessons for a year, but he had a teacher briefly and the teacher was teaching him stuff that was way too advanced, like by all means. He was learning like jazz rhythms using all his 2 feet and hands at the same time and was picking it up. You know, and not in a way that was like, oh, it's obnoxious sounding. It was like, okay, I hear what he's trying to do in the rhythm. And I think what's impressive with any kid and human being are the ones where it just clicks. Like he can pick up the piano, same kid, and he can hear a song. And within an hour or two, he has it pretty much worked out by ear.
Yeah.
Know? And that's a God-given talent to be able to do that and sort it out, you know? Go ahead.
Yeah. To comment on that, what I think is so amazing about music, like drums are this way, guitar, piano, every musical instrument is the instantaneous feedback you get playing. You can immediately play something, begin to learn it, and have that feedback to know how you're doing. And really the only thing that gets in the way of that feedback is just your level of self-awareness on the instrument. So what I find interesting is So what I was describing to someone the other day is I sit most days and try to dedicate an hour to reading. It's such a valuable thing. I'm surrounded in the room I'm in by books, and I love them. I adore them. That's part of why I named my own podcast Novels, because it's about, you know, really engaging with all this information. We live in this digital age, and I still like picking up an analog book. And while I'm reading a book in analog, something that I find really fascinating is I can't always tell how quickly I'm processing the information. It's not until later when I need to recall that information that I truly know what I absorbed, what's impacted me, and it might come up in the most obtuse or strange of moments. Yet with music, your kind of level of feedback is instant. As you're playing something, as you're learning, you have this instant feedback of your progress. And then when I mentioned a second ago self-awareness, what that is as your experience of the instrument grows, like I am always able to hear better drumming than I am able to play it. My ear is always just a little bit ahead of my playing, and that's what you want, because that enables you to recognize where you need to go and whether or not what you're playing today is sufficient enough for where you want to get to. The worst, you know, case scenario is where your ear and your playing are so similar that you can't really tell how to get better, or you can't really tell, like, people will always listen. Here's a great example. They'll always listen to AC/DC. And you can immediately tell an inexperienced drummer, because he'll say, "That's so easy, I can play that." And you're like, "You don't get it. You have no clue. You have no clue." So that level of
– tell me why that's so complex. So again, I don't know. So I didn't grow up with instruments. I love music. I would wish I learned to play music. What makes that more difficult than what people think?
This would be like this is relevant to business in the sense that – the best ideas are the simplest ones. I think we go through phases in life of trying to complicate things and thinking that complication is beautiful. And that's kind of the rise of amateurism. It's when you become an amateur that you start to really think being busy and technical is what people care about. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I think it's a great analogy. Go ahead.
Yeah, and it's funny because I think what starts to happen, even though I'm a pup over here, I know I'm young, and so many of the guests you have, James, are just phenomenal, brilliant business people. I would imagine you're seeing a lot of the same similarities I am, in that most of the most brilliant people think very simply. They don't complicate their language. They don't complicate their behavior, and that actually adds to their wisdom. And I think that's the same with music. So when you listen to, you know, AC/DC, as just because I gave that example, most of the time, Phil Rudd, their previous drummer, was playing the most basic of drum beats, like one of the first beats your kid probably learned, James. The difference is when you use that same idea for years and you practice it and you play it, the placement of your notes, the consistency of your notes, they actually start to expose your true skill in a different way. It's like this. I can play a lot of notes in time and make it sound like all those notes sound good because they're happening so fast, it's hard to tell. But then when I go back to playing something really simple, there's space. And space is what creates music. And the more space you have, the easier it is to identify how consistent someone is, how cleanly they hit the instrument or play the instrument, or how cleanly they subdivide notes. It's just beautiful. Like the best musicians are always the ones who can embrace simplicity.
I love that analogy back to business, as you're right. I think some of the wisest people, and I think it's more wisdom than it is anything else. I think that the individuals I've interviewed who I put on a different level, and I appreciate that compliment. You know, I've had a lot of good ones, are the ones who just can boil it down to one simple or two simple ideas at the end of the day. And I actually think the other thing, and I love what you also said about the idea of amateurism, sometimes they make it complex. But once they stop making it complex, that means they've evolved in their learning process and their understanding and their ability to deliver it in a simple way. So yeah. As someone who teaches, like you teach and I teach, I find that the longer I do it, the better I am at explaining things in a more simple manner, because the more I've seen it, been exposed to it, talked about it, and have gotten feedback from who my audience is to figure out if they're getting it or not getting it. So my wisdom has grown on how to interpret and deliver a message in an efficient and effective way.
Yeah, that's exactly it. It's like writing lyrics. When you listen to really complicated lyrics, you could listen to a song that had, let's say, you know, Shakespearean level lyrics in some ways, and they were really beautiful and elegant, but maybe a little bit complex, and there was a lot of meaning, and there's a lot of depth. Those lyrics sometimes can almost be easier to write than the most simple lyrics that communicate a message in the most powerful way.
Twitter, you know? Man.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely.
So now, do you have any brothers or sisters?
Yeah, I have two sisters.
And, younger, older?
Yeah. Both younger. One's a year younger. One's 3 years younger. My sister, who's a year younger, moved out west. She lives for a while. She's living in British Columbia, but now in Alberta. She's a cowgirl in every sense, rides horses every day, and is living her dream from childhood. She was always obsessed with horses, and now she's got a bunch. She married a cowboy. They're happy as could be. And my sister, who's 3 years younger than me, is a destinations photographer. So in just, I don't know, maybe the last 6-7 years, she graduated the school she went to for college, which was like a pretty popular school here in the area called Sheridan. And she's gone on to be one of the most successful photographers in our area for weddings. She's booked like years in advance and is just rock solid in what she does.
I think that's awesome. So what does your dad do?
Yeah, so it is awesome, because you're about to kind of uncover, I think, my family in its truest sense, which is all of us pursued the things we were most passionate about. And my father's an electrical engineer. He's had the same job for, I think, almost 30 years, despite the fact he's 51 now. So pretty impressive amount of time that he spent at one place. And my mom is where I think all of us really gravitated to. She's today in school as a 49-year-old to be an osteopath.
And, that's awesome.
She's just crazy. And, you know, she's probably had 10 careers that I've watched happen, and she's been remarkably successful in everything she's done, from becoming an RMT most recently, to Thai massage, to Swedish massage, to becoming a yoga master trainer, to being a graphic artist, a mural artist, an aerobics instructor. I mean, everything. And she's just been the best at all of it.
Well, you know what's awesome about that, though, is that your parents are like yin and yang, right?
Totally.
So you've got this dad who's probably a bit more type A, a bit more structured, right? And you got this mom who, for lack of a better term, is kind of hippy-dippy. Like, I want to be in touch with myself and feelings and, like, you know, passionate is probably the better term. So, like, what was it like growing up in this house where you have kind of more of this dad who's the traditional, in my mind, type A dad who wants structure, and this mom who's kind of like, let it go?
Oh, man. You know what it looked like? It looked like, hey, dad, can I go do this? No. Hey, mom, can I go do this? Yes. That's what it looked like. Always. You knew mom was good.
Did you just start bypassing? Like, did you build your own like bypass and just go right by your dad to your mom?
'Cause 100%.
I feel like, yeah.
Yeah. She was always good. She was, you know, it was funny because it was beautiful. It was, it taught me a lot about my
manipulation.
Dad's perspective. Manipulation taught me a lot about that.
Kidding. I'm totally
kidding.
Taught me a
lot about,
by the way, as a parent, I feel like I could say that. So as a parent, I could be like, you know, because I see my kids try to do that sometimes. Sorry, go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, it's so true. And it's, I think it's a beautiful thing to have that dichotomy of personality, because it definitely teaches you to kind of pay attention to who you want to be and what qualities you want to draw, knowing that both of them are like all of us, flawed. You know, both of them have amazing strengths, and then both of them have flaws. And you kind of get to, at a young age, as much as I don't think you really get to choose, you kind of get to choose. You get to decide what it is you want to take with you, and then what things you want to start to be very proactive about leaving behind.
And I think that's the challenge, right? So, you know, we are 17 years apart. Is that right? You're 25.
I think so.
That's 15, yeah, 17 years apart. And, you know, I didn't get married until I was 32. And so before I was 32, I lived in four major cities in the U.S., three major cities. I had lived in two countries at that point. And wow. I was in the middle of my PhD. And so, you know, I had this totally different experience than my wife, who grew up in this traditional Irish Catholic family. So family dinners, and I had those, but like family dinners, pray every night, church every weekend. And you go to college, you get a job. For her, it wasn't stated, but I think it was unstated. You be a stay-at-home mom, which is totally cool because we couldn't do what we do without her. And then that's it. That's your life. That's what her mom did. That's what her grandma did. Some aunts did this. I mean, so she's seen this role model again and again in her life. But she meets me, and I got this liberal Canadian mom who's super outspoken. She left her house at 18 as a Catholic, got married to a Jew, and moved out to Vancouver, BC. And then they moved out. They moved out to Oregon, and then they got divorced. So he left her for her best friend, and then she married my dad, who was a Protestant. Right. So I always joke with my mom. I said, "Well, why'd you leave the church?" And she always goes, "I have issues with the Pope." And I was like, "Well, did you talk to him? Like, what did he say to you? Like, what do you?" So like, anyhow. So I didn't grow up with this big faith family. So now my kids have this dichotomy of my wife, who teaches them Sunday school every week, and when we're all together at dinner, it's pray at dinner, and then there's me, who's like, "Do we have to go to church?" And da-da-da. Like, I'll go because that's the right thing to do. So I was kind of thinking about that in your house, where you've got, and the other thing you mentioned, by the way, was church. So you guys grow up, which I think is fascinating, and your mom is kind of this holistic person. So then what kind of church did you guys go to?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I grew up going to a Pentecostal church. So, you know, not a church, not a denomination, I should say, that's particularly accepting of a lot of the practices that we've embraced. And you know what? I think for us, it's just, we try and do everything in love. We try and also really have as a family, a really realistic perspective of what we believe. And I think when I was younger, in a lot of ways, I walked away from what I believed. And it was a little bit of a rediscovery process, because I think I went through all the thoughts that every human being on the planet goes through, which is, why am I here? You know, what is really the purpose of this life? What really matters? And, you know, James, like, I know I'm still young. I'm rediscovering these things all the time. Like, last week, my sister, while I was in the middle of a podcast, starts screaming my name, frantic, downstairs. And just to preface this, I still live with my parents. I'm in the middle of having a condo built, which is a whole other process and a journey. And so I'm upstairs in my home office, and I hear screaming downstairs, which is quite unusual. So I'm alarmed, go to the edge of the staircase. I'm like, "What's going on?" And she's yelling at me to call an ambulance. So I run, I grab my phone, run downstairs, and my mom is lying on her side. Like, remember just a second ago, my mom is in the best shape of her life. People can't believe she's the age she is, you know, being late 40s, and healthy as could be, has a great diet, great practice, like I mentioned, with yoga. So she's breathing all the time, low stress. And she's lying on her side, passing in and out of consciousness with stroke-like symptoms, where the left side of her face was drooping. She could hardly speak, couldn't remember her name. Just terrifying. And, you know, in that moment, my life is changing, just like, at least in my mind it is, for a moment. And I'm beginning to think, am I now a caretaker? Like, what does my life look like? Is my father now a caretaker? You know, like, my mom, with all this talent she's been acquiring through school, like, where does that go? Just all these challenging questions. And my schedule at that moment doesn't matter. What I have planned for the rest of the day is irrelevant. What I have planned for the next week or month doesn't matter either. And I found myself driving down to the hospital following the ambulance, just thinking, like, you know, what really matters right now? What is it that I want to be focused on in life, that if this is it for my mom, like, what matters, you know? So anyways, we got to the hospital. By what I believe to be some divine miracle, it was just this form of a migraine that can surface in a whole number of ways. It had no headache that prefaced it. It just had this numbness and paralysis that started to slowly graduate down the left side of her body. And it turns out that she's 100% recovered now, which is amazing. No signs of any long-term damage, which is phenomenal. But it turns out it was actually most related to this tooth sore that she had that she wasn't really aware of. The dentist didn't think it was a big deal, and it led to this whole crazy situation. So I say all that to say that, you know, in life, I'm constantly reassessing what's valuable. And I think I see this tension in the world. You know, we don't have to get too crazy with this because this is – I could turn into, you know, preaching about a bunch of stuff, and that's not my goal. But right now what I will share is you see this tension in the world of it feels like everyone all the time is competing to have more. And then the irony I find is that the people who have more and then, you know, take their lives, it's just such a confusing thing where you're like, they had everything. Even people who have amazing family lives, you know, look at Robin Williams, mm-hmm. just this unbelievable man who people all over the world, and Tony Robbins talks about this all the time. This is a guy who people everywhere he went would say that they love that guy. And, you know, financially, I'm sure he was in a great spot. His family loved him. You know, these people cherished him. And yet he was just ridden with sorrow and hurt in his life that caused him to make this crazy decision, you know? And I can't help but think, like, what really matters in life isn't so clear. And it's in direct competition with what the world tells us matters, you know? I see Ferraris all the time. And I'm like, I would love to have a Ferrari. One day I'm going to own a Ferrari. But then when I think about the fact that I see all these other miserable people that drive Ferraris, I'm like, maybe happiness isn't in a Ferrari, you know?
You know, I just I just published an interview so today. So listen to it because it's pretty interesting. It's a guy named Mo Gadot. Mo is
from
the
Google?
Yeah. So
that's just listening to that one a little bit. It's great.
He is phenomenal. And this is a guy who probably had more money than any than I probably will ever have. Let's put it that way. I can't speak for you. You still have time, but you'll have more money probably than I'll ever have. And you could just tell that through everything he's been through, he realized that none of that means a hill of beans at all. Mm. And his whole thing is about just being here, present, enjoying the moment. And that's one of the things that I've learned a lot from talking to a lot of leaders is that their whole premise is not so much about what I've done and where I'm going, but I'm just happy. And these are the ones who are usually towards the end of their career, who've had some sort of major trauma, but they really just kind of realize that just being is more important. That's what makes them happiest.
Yeah.
And I think for many of us, that can be a challenge. For many of us, it's a journey. For many of us, we get there at 25, we get there at 75, you know? There's no right or wrong way. But I think what you said really strikes me is the idea of mortality. Mm. And mortality, we all are mortals, you know? So
yeah.
Being from Portland, Oregon, there was just that news story of, you know, those three men that stood up to that guy who was basically a white supremacist yelling at girls on the train, and the guy stabbed and killed two of them.
Oh, man.
You know, and it's a very tragic story. But in the same note, it's great to know that there are still humans out there who are willing to take the risk to do what's right.
Yeah.
That's mortality, right? So One guy was 22. One guy was like 51. And it's sad. You know, my dad died at 49. So for me, you know, you saw your mom laying down and you're like, great, here are all the consequences. I lived through those consequences. And, you know, you quite often, and I was 20 when my dad died. So, you know, the conversation I have with myself and I've had with my mom and Mary, who's my wife, is I don't know how my life would be different. But if I spent a significant amount of time wondering how it'd be different, then I wouldn't appreciate where I've come from and who I am now. So, you know, just to kind of give you some context on that, you know, for me, if my dad hadn't died, there is no way in hell for sure that I would have gone on if I got my PhD. There's just no way.
Wow.
I wouldn't have got that nudge. And I wouldn't have most likely lived in a couple of countries. I most likely wouldn't have moved to the Middle East, you know, where I'm at now. I most likely wouldn't have married my wife. Like, there's so many things in my life would have been different just from that death where I had to kind of go through this dark space and try to create a sense of identity of who I am. Because I think what you'll see as you get older, and you see it probably now, is that you're a combination of your parents. And as you move forward, you figure out which one of those is the dominant figure of you. I don't have that slate. I don't have that. I have my mom, who is bitter and sad and depressed. She's had a pretty shitty life, some high moments, but mostly mediocre or low moments, if I was to rate it. I know that sounds really harsh, but it's a self-perpetuating sense of dissatisfaction and creating situations that are negative and so forth and so on. So I know what my mom is, and I'm not that, but I don't know what my dad would be. So I'm kind of creating my own masterpiece, which is scary because I don't have any models about what it should be. But it's also kind of refreshing to say I have no constraints on what I can't and can do, if that makes sense.
It does, yeah. And I think it's from that place that some of the most amazing people are crafted. It's from that place of tragedy at a young age. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah. Malcolm Gladwell talks about this so much, James, with I can't remember which book. It might be Outliers, might be Tipping Point. And he talks about how
they're all bestsellers. It doesn't matter.
That's it. They're all bestsellers. Malcolm Gladwell wins every time.
I know. Canadian.
Yeah, what a guy. Yeah. What a guy.
Go ahead.
And it's funny though, because what he talks about is he talks about this concept of people who have suffered tragedy, and he specifically is relating it to the loss of a mother or a father at a young age and how that shapes these people's lives. And he goes really in depth to show you a number of examples. And I wish I knew which book specifically, but if you were just to search that in Google, you could find it for sure. And he's just talking about how these people are who they are because of that loss. So, you know, I think definitely in life, it's like you said a minute ago with the most previous guest you had on the show, it's being present. Mm-hmm. And I look at my mom differently now because there was a moment where, you know, even just almost 2 years ago now, my business partner with 180 lost his mother in the middle of the night for no reason. She passed away. And it's just been on this journey. I had a friend 2 weeks ago tell me, he's my age, tell me that he has testicular cancer and that he was going to have to go through chemotherapy. Just these unbelievable moments in the last little bit of realizing the temporariness of life, the quickness. And, you know, in Proverbs, it mentions life is like a vapor. Like all your days are like a breath before you. It's just, it comes and it goes. And that couldn't be more true.
So Jake, I was thinking about, you were talking about your mom. What did your dad do? Because I think sometimes this is when you can see the most vulnerability in your parents' relationship in terms of dependence in some ways. Did your dad, was he really freaked out about this?
That's a great question, because I think that definitely gives a deep look. And I've seen my dad cry maybe 3 times in my life, and they've all been
he's an electrical engineer.
That's it. That's right. Calculates each tier, right? It's gotta be a good tier.
How much salt is in this tier? Can I waste
That's it? Right. Go ahead. And, you know, it's funny because when I called him, my mom from the ground was saying, "Try not to sound panicked." That's what she was trying to mutter. So I just said, "Hey man, listen, you know, mom's not feeling super well. We're going to take her down to the hospital. She's, you know, currently feeling a little bit under the weather." And I was trying to think about how to deliver this information, you know? So that's right. Yeah. And, when I met him there at the hospital, his immediate reaction was actually, he was quite calm and composed. And, his immediate reaction was to want to kind of like distract himself. I think that's how a lot of the things he's faced in life have been. It's, you know, he lost his father maybe 10 years ago now, about a decade ago, my grandfather. And he talks about my grandfather like that man was a saint. He could have done no wrong in my dad's eyes. And most people view my grandfather that way. He's this amazing man. And yet when I've tried to initiate conversations about my grandfather, the reaction is, I don't want to talk about that. It hurts too much to talk about it. So I'd rather not. And it's a shame, you know? So I think that's the way we've handled things a little bit from the masculine side is try to bottle it down, try to put it away because feelings are scary. And I've really fought against that. I've chosen the opposite, which is I cry regularly. I'll watch a good movie. I'll cry. I'm soft.
I love it. Way, no, it's not soft. It's being real. So yeah, I don't look at it like that.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think I do either. It's just it's fun to play off culturally the perspective, which is at the end of the day, man, the people that I respect most are in touch with who they are. And I think it's like learning to embrace empathy, right? When you can cry, you're saying, I can imagine what that would feel like, and I'm with you, you know?
So I tend to think a lot what you're supposed to do in these podcasts. So so was your dad raised – because I'm thinking of the analogy of my mom, right? So my mom is very similar. She won't talk about my dad's death. She refuses to acknowledge any hardships or at least outwardly acknowledge it, which when bottled up is a volcano. Was your dad raised Pentecostal or was he raised – like I assume Catholic. It's because my mom's – but I don't think that's the case.
Yeah, you know what? He was, and from my understanding, he was, but
Catholic or Pentecostal?
No, definitely Pentecostal. Like, definitely, if not, maybe Baptist. But I know for him, the thing that he had to deal with that was really challenging is he had this father who was an amazing man, maybe a little bit more of a pushover than he needed to be, my grandfather, in some ways. An amazing man, though, but I don't know if he always stood his ground on big things just because there were some things that happened in the family and it might have not felt like he really stood his ground. But yet my grandmother suffers from bipolar. So that, I think, really affected his ability to have a stable emotional childhood. And he also has brothers that are 10 and 12 years older than him. Mm-hmm. So that divide probably – and he was one of the youngest, so five. Yeah.
Yeah, that makes a huge sense. All right. So what I want to do, because you've been awesome with your time, is do my little segment called Fast Five. And then let's talk about what you're doing on the education, where it came from, the success you're having. You know, as I start looking into it, it's really kind of a cool niche thing that you're doing. So are you ready to do Fast Five?
Let's do it, man.
Okay, good, because – I don't know why I asked. You don't have a choice. You got to say yes. So
you got to say yes.
All right.
Skype call ends.
Damn it again. all right. So question one, what was your first job ever? First paid gig?
First paid job ever was working at my other grandfather, my mom's dad's car lot, washing cars and driving them around the parking lot as fast as I could in the 30 seconds I had to get in the car before I had my license.
Did he own a dealership?
He did. Yeah. Owned a dealership here in Hamilton.
So my first real job, but my first quasi adult job, I actually quit college at 18, went for a year, quit. Or university, and I sold cars for a year.
Wow!
At a new and used Chevrolet car dealership in Portland, Oregon, and I did that until I saw two guys doing coke in a shack, and they offered me to do coke, and I was like, you know, I see two distinctly different paths right now. I think I'm going to go back to university at this point. But
oh, good for you, man.
But I remember driving those cars and having so much fun driving cars on those lots. So
oh, it's the best, man. Yeah. It's the best. For me, I was like 12, so it was just unbelievable to get to drive a car.
And I feel somewhat illegal, but that's all right. Details.
That's it.
All right, question two. Who do you admire most?
I would say I admire both my father and mother in different ways. I would say then we talked about them enough. So I'd say from a business perspective, someone I really admire a lot is actually Tony Robbins. I think he gets kind of pushed down this self-help category at times. And he undeniably is that in certain ways. But I think his compassion for people is quite profound. And it's something that lately has really impacted the way I think about the value add to people's lives.
Did you ever see his special on Netflix?
I did. And yeah. I think if you can get through it, because I know there's – I've read some terrible reviews. But yet I really enjoy it because his ability to identify – like when you're watching the first suicide case with this guy who's crying and when he's – you see Tony holding this guy's shoulders while he's talking to him. And you can see the moment where Tony goes, "What just happened?" And I had to rewind, and you can actually see the guy's shoulders just drop. And Tony's just so in tune with body language, like when it comes to NLP, neuro-linguistic programming, and his ability to identify what words to use, how he even talks about swear words being something that are so taboo, he uses them to immediately shock people back into the present moment. It's brilliant.
Now, I watched that, and I loved it. Like, I was memorized.
Yeah.
By his process. And to your point, like each person, he he connects differently with because he's so good at understanding what that person needs to shake them out, to change their trajectory. Like it's an amazing skill set. I mean, it's unbelievable. But he's also someone who had a ton of tragedy as a kid, right?
That's so, it. That's exactly right.
All right, question three. I'll be interested to see how you answer this. What animal best represents your management style?
Now, I heard you ask this one in the other interview, and I was like, there's no way he's going to ask me that because I don't possibly have an answer for that. Management style. Shoot, I should have thought about it.
How about I'll change it for you? What animal best represents your drumming style?
Oh, there you go. There you go. It'd be what would it be? My drumming style. Let me think about this. This is good.
I assume there's different styles, so...
You know what? It'd probably be a rhino, man. Just like straightforward, full aggression. That's me, man.
What kind of music do you play? Or do you specialize, or do you like to play?
That's a great question. It's a great question because it's just so versatile in the world of music. What I gravitate to is anything that's funky, man. It's got to feel good. It's got to be somewhat simple in nature and just be something that people can dance to. So I love a lot of R&B stuff, a lot of soul, a lot of funk. That's what I listen to the most.
That's awesome. All right. Question four, as you're doing your job and you're working with people and you're trying to get this company going, what are traits that annoy you the most in your colleagues?
Man, you know, being an A-type, I think it's always frustrating when people don't know how to use computer shortcuts. Drives me crazy. I'm in the middle, James. I'll tell you, man, I'm in the middle of training up a couple of VAs and, I literally am like, okay, listen, as we start this training, I just want to let you know that I'm going to teach you every shortcut I know and I'm going to expect you to use them. And it's just, I can't handle when people want to like click on everything with their mouse or they want to everything. I know all these crazy shortcuts and it's really painful to watch other people operate a computer.
I want to ask you this question again in 15 years and see how your response changes.
That's right. That's right. You know what? It's just, I think more than anything, to be more accurate with the answer, it's efficiencies. It's seeing inefficiencies and learning to be patient with it. It's definitely the Michael Gerber e-myth of just having to hand stuff off, knowing that people aren't going to do it the way you want them to do it. So I'd say it's just a level of excellence in what you do. And the shortcuts to me are just the greatest embodiment of having excellence in navigating a computer.
That's your dad's electrical engineer side. All right. So,
that's it, man.
So speaking of Michael Gerber book, which by the way, I recommend that to every entrepreneur out there. It's a great book.
Phenomenal book.
But he wrote it from a point of simplicity. And I actually love the idea of a bake shop and like creating efficiencies. I don't know. I think it's a great book to get your head around. What did you learn when you read that?
You know what? I mean, some books, just to speak to efficiency for a second, some books that have been really, that are probably more relevant to recent reads that I reflect on really regularly would be the book One Thing by Gary Keller, a phenomenal read. And then I'm actually in the middle of reading The Power of Habit right now. And it's something that's just, it's haunted me forever because it's one of those books that everybody, when they see I have it, are like, why haven't you read it yet? It's just surrounded by so many books. But these two books of zeroing in on the simplicity of knowing what your strengths are, knowing what things you really enjoy doing, and then everything else that maybe isn't a strength or is something that at the end of the day, you could pay someone else to do and they're going to be able to execute on it. And it's something that you don't have to do, I think is really profound. So, you know, even in my own personal time, discovering the power of a VA, it's realizing like I'll go to do some simple sales outreach to some people I might need to, or getting some people on the podcast and realizing, you know what, that's actually something that someone else is just as intelligent to be able to really run through and do effectively, if not better than me. Why wouldn't I hand that off? Why would I try and do everything? So I've been really kind of learning that in life, just the power of handing things off.
Yeah, I feel like that's a struggle for me. So I'm getting better. But for example, take the podcast as an example. I could hire a company to go edit it for sure. And they could do it and that will take it off my plate. But I still have to listen to it again, right? So I just think to myself, why bother? Like I still got to spend the hour and a half, 2 hours to listen to it. And – you know, so I think to myself, well, I don't want to give that job up then and pay someone. I'll just do it myself. You know, certain things like that where I know I could hand it off, but then I feel like, well, I'm going to have to still do it anyways in the back end. So why bother?
Let me ask you a question. Why would you have to listen to anything other than the intro and the outro?
Because for me, it's a way to remember what the conversation was about.
So, yeah. Yeah.
So like, as you know, you do enough of these, they all start to kind of blend together. And so it's really important to me that if I interview someone, like when I listen to ours again, I'll take some notes and I'll say, what was the good connections we had? What do we not have? Right. So that's why I do it, because right now I couldn't take notes on what was exciting or not, because I need to process it. I need to think about it. I need to like then listen to it when it's not in the moment.
Yes.
Sorry. So we've talked about what annoys you with your colleagues. What I want to know on the opposite side of that is, what brings out the best in Jake?
I think what brings out the best in me, other than some of the obvious things like encouragement, I think what's been the most eye-opening working with the team has been deepening my own self-awareness. So, you know, maybe this sounds funny, but I had no idea that I was an intense personality, and I don't even know that would come through in this single podcast episode. But so my friends around me, there was a day where we were, this is when we were, and I call them my friends, cause as much as they're colleagues at this point, we keep a tight team with 180. We've really mastered being a small team. And, what's funny is we were spending maybe 10 hours a day shooting drum lesson videos when we first started. And this is no joke. We shot 180 10-minute videos, and we threw all of them in the garbage when we were done. So we spent like thousands of hours together, and we threw all of that in the garbage, all that time, all that money, because we had our first guest in, and we loved the dynamic of having two people in the room. So that's just to preface it to say, I spent a lot of time with these people. And I remember one day there was the comment made by one of the guys. They said, you know, it's kind of like how Jake's intense. And the other guy laughs. And I was like, what do you mean I'm intense? And they're like, oh, they both had this shock look on their face. Like, you don't know this about yourself? They're like, dude, like, you know, you're intense. Like, that's who you are. You're intense. And I was like, no, man, I'm super chill.
As you're getting intense.
No, I'm like, I'm super chill. I'm really relaxed. Like right now I'm chill. You know, I'm hanging out. And they're like, no, dude, no, not at all. You're a really intense guy. And they're like, that, don't get us wrong. That's one of the best qualities about you, is that you're intense, but you have to know that you're intense. And that really set me on this journey of deepening without feeling self-conscious, just learning to deepen my self-awareness. So what brings out the best in me? Being self-aware, being aware of my strengths and my weaknesses, and having people around me who feel comfortable to tell me the way I'm acting, what they really think, and shoot down ideas. That's the best thing in the world.
So it's great that you said that, because I'm in the middle of writing a book, and it's about authentic leadership. And one of the critical traits that I've learned by interviewing all these people are the people who are highly successful are really self-aware. They have the ability to assess their skill set and how to utilize their strengths and support their weaknesses. And you only can do that by being able to look in the mirror and say, okay, I am who I am. And of course, I always try to improve what I'm not good at, but I have my limits. And here's what I'm great at, and I'm going to excel the hell out of that. And so I love that you said that that's your journey you're on, because that's what I found with a lot of these successful leaders, is this ability to be self-aware and to take a moment and pause and reflect. So yeah, good for you. Good for you.
It's so critical. And I think having people around you, like one of the stories you should probably use in the book, that's one of my favorite stories ever, is Bono punching Edge in the face. they were playing music somewhere, and like Edge was doing something to piss off Bono, and he just punched him square in the nose. And later he talked about the beauty and the importance of having people around you that disagree with you. That I'm sure the other guy didn't realize that meant he was going to get punched in the face. Yeah. But the truth of the matter is, it's so critical to not just be self-aware, but have people around you who are going to take your self-awareness to a level higher than you're going to be able to just perceive on your own, you know?
Mm-hmm. That's awesome. All right. Well, thanks for being Fast Five. That was an extended version. the uncut
My
version.
Fault.
No one's fault. So, you know, I have about 5 or 10 minutes. Let's talk about this concept of 180, where it's going, where you hope it goes. So tell me the concept of 180, where it came from.
The concept really came from seeing that there was an opportunity to educate more drummers online and you know, really more musicians online. Just seeing that things are heading increasingly towards people being comfortable using devices to educate themselves. And the reality was I had been also teaching drums while I was out touring. And when I'd be away from my students, I would try and send them to other resources. And I just felt kind of defeated with the lack of structure in other resources and the lack of attention to details. I just felt like it was about time someone created an online learning platform that felt like an Apple product, but was accessible to drummers. And it was also a really selfish way for me to get to sit with all my favorite drummers, put some money in their pocket, and earn a living doing it. So the vision is, yeah, it's just education, and it's about bringing people together, bringing them into community where they can learn from the luxury of their own home.
So what's the business model there?
Right now, what we've been doing is charging a monthly fee. So for $20 a month, you can access over 500 video lessons that are broken down from total beginner, how to, you know, set up your drum set, how to hold your drumsticks, how to tune your drums, all the way to, you know, like the most challenging groove you can imagine. Like you mentioned earlier with your son's four-way independence between two hands and 2 feet, the most complicated stuff, and just kind of walking you on this really linear journey throughout the process of learning drums.
So I think that's really interesting. And is there a big, I mean, clearly there's a demand for it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Were you surprised by the demand for it?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing I've been surprised by is just the amount of receptivity to people looking to learn online. I think I was a little bit worried that people weren't going to want to learn online, or they were going to gravitate to just wanting an in-person teacher. And I think it's not a replacement for an in-person teacher, but it's the most beautiful $20 compliment you could ever add to a learning experience.
That's actually well said that way, because you're right. There's not that instant feedback from a teacher, but we're in a world where people are self-taught 1,000 different things. So,
yeah.
I mean, that's how my son learns the piano songs he wants to learn, is he'll go on to some YouTube channel, watch it, figure it out, learn the keys, and then go.
Yeah.
You know?
Absolutely. The problem is, too, you can end up with a bad teacher. Look at your son's example, where he's playing with a teacher who is, you know, teaching him things that were too difficult, which is, again, amateurism, right? But he's teaching him things that are too difficult because, who knows, maybe he's too self-conscious to teach him simple concepts, or he feels better about himself teaching him advanced things. And maybe you don't have a lot of other drum teachers in the area. So online is a really good solution for your family. It just depends. And financially, it's a really good option for people who maybe can't afford the minimum $100 a month it costs to hire a private instructor. And then you're driving to that lesson, and you can definitely run into some issues. So what I try to encourage students to do, because I still have students of my own, is encourage them to be using it as an online tool to learn from home, and then you know, having that instant feedback while in person.
So that might be something we do, because, you know, right now, you know, as I have multiple kids, because my son is doing piano and drums, and he only practices drums once a week. We had my wife, she bought a drum kit, right? But it was a junior drum kit. And so he looks like he is Andre the Giant, like enormous on it. It doesn't fit him. And so he's kind of turned off from actually even doing the drums. So we're going to get an electronic drum kit so we can put it in the main floor next to the piano, and he can just put headphones on and play after we get back from vacation. But I think this is a good supplement for him, because he's such a good self-learner to use it for now. Like, he's 9, right? And so as long as he's learning the fundamentals, then, again, I don't know what your take is. This is an ad hoc music teacher who has no credentials saying, as long as he's learning fundamentals, I mean, I don't know if he'll be a rock star or not, but he's content to do it.
I honestly think the most important thing with any type of education, I look at education now like investing. It's a marathon. It's not a sprint. Mm-hmm. And it's about, you know, over long periods of time, just continuing to put money in the bank. And I think that's the same with education, is that it matters more than anything as well that he's passionate about it and excited about it. And trying to find times, I mean, for me, even practicing drums these days, when I get the chance to do that, I try and really build it around when I'm most excited to go sit down, so it feels less like a task, because that's when the creativity really flows. That's when you're really enjoying what you're doing, and when you're enjoying it, your consciousness is heightened.
So now, what do you hope to accomplish with this? I mean, when you started this, you know, were your goals to have this company that's growing exponentially, or was it just kind of, let's give it a shot?
Huh. Yeah, it was a little bit of both. It was a little bit of like, let's give this a shot. And in the meanwhile, let's brainstorm where we think we could take this thing. I think there's a lot of opportunity. I'll just say this without giving too much away in case any of our competitors decide to listen to this, which would be good for them. It's be a good idea. My biggest advice would be that education is simply a means to a different end. And I look at education as trust. When you can be the educator, you're going to garner trust and you're going to garner traffic. You're going to have the opportunity to build relationships in a way that's different than just selling a product or service. It's the same reason for yourself. The listeners of this podcast are going to be more motivated to trust you with something because they feel like they know you. And with education, when someone can look back on a journey they've taken and directly link that to what you provided them, there's something so deep there that isn't replaced easily, you know? So we look at education as simply a means to start moving in other areas of the business, which is either distribution of products or partnerships with other brands. We see the value in numbers and then the value in partnerships.
So you keep saying something to me that I think is really awesome. And I don't know if you know what I do is my quote unquote day job, but I'm a marketing professor. And so mistakes that companies tend to make is they define themselves by what they do. So give me an example, you know, Amtrak in the States, you know, they define themselves as a train company, as an example, not a transportation company. So if they were transportation, they would be more flexible and come up with different modes of transporting people. And what you keep saying, going back to, is we're an education company, not a drum education company. We happen to educate on the drums, but we're an education company first. Yeah. And I think that's a really important thing that I hope you guys hold on to, because that will allow you to be flexible in what you offer.
Oh, I love it.
And it's such an important thing for a company to allow themselves strategically to have that flexibility to move within an industry that fits their core capabilities, which is educating. The drums is the outcome, but the education is what and who you are and what you do. So I really love that you talk that way. Not, yeah, we're an online drum education. Like, you, I didn't hear you say that once unless I asked the question. So I'm giving you kudos. And I think it's really impactful that you've made that distinction and that you're talking in education, not in drums.
You know, it's funny. We had a team meeting this past week. We sat down and the first thing I brought up to the team was, I said, like, just listen to this quote again, guys. I know we've all heard it, but Starbucks, right? Starbucks isn't a coffee company that serves people. They're a company that serves people and happens to also have coffee, right? They're in the customer service business, and then they also happen to serve coffee. And I think that's the perspective you always want to have from a marketing perspective, is like, what is the real value I provide? If you removed all of the actual tangibles of the drums and everything else, and you just said, what do our interactions look like? That's what your company is.
That's awesome. That was a great example. I'm thinking Google's the same way. Like, they're not a search company. They're an information getting company. Right. So, you know, and I can't, I'm paraphrasing what they call themselves, but it's basically everything's at one fingertip away, right? All information, but it's not a, you know, online search company. So I think that's really important. That's awesome that you do that. So listen, Jake, your time has been invaluable. And I appreciate your time, energy, and willingness to sit down with me on Executives After Hours. Thank you so much.
The honor is all mine, my friend.
Oh, I have one more question. I almost forgot my capper question. How do you define happiness, Jake? Sorry, I need to ask that.
I define happiness as a cup of hot coffee, sitting with some friends, playing a game of chess.
At Starbucks, the coffee store?
No, not at Starbucks. I would way rather some little indie, hidden, tucked away coffee shop.
That's awesome. Thank you again.